Good evening. This evening I want to explore equanimity. So we've come to the last of the four. Did you think we would get here? And it said that equanimity is the crown and culmination of the Brahma-Vihara, or the four. And it's the one where we can really see how all four of them get more integrated, more connected. And so a theme of the retreat has been how we connect wisdom and mindfulness with the, we might say, the opening of the heart. So I want to continue that theme and show how equanimity is, among the four, it's a factor that brings in more the wisdom aspect. But it also has to have a heart aspect. And so that's what I want to explore and cover this evening. And so several nights ago, I talked about how there are tendencies to split wisdom and the open heart. Sometimes that will be a split between the mind and the emotions. And I don't know how it is in Israel in terms of education, but in most schools and universities in the U.S., you don't learn too much about mudita. Is that true here? Not so much about mudita, not so much about compassion, not even about metta or love. And rather, the focus is on what? More mental development, not necessarily wisdom, right? And so we are making a cultural correction, you know, which hopefully will expand out and help create different culture. You know, maybe we start with our families and our communities, and then potentially it gets bigger because we need a lot of wisdom and compassion to work with the many systemic crises of our times. Yeah. And so I often think of the person who is engaged to really meet these challenges, whether it's climate or political challenges or economic challenges, as someone who is trained in what we're exploring on this retreat, and is also very skilled in working with systems. So it's a kind of a new kind of being. In Buddhism we have the Bodhisattva, who is dedicated to inner development but also helping others. So I hope that all of you see yourselves as Bodhisattvas. So we have those kind of cultural splits between the mind and emotions. And also, I think this was the question from Ruth yesterday, that we can find at times what seems like a contradiction or tension in Buddhist practice as well, between what seems to be the wisdom dimension and what seems to be the heart dimension, if we call it that. And it's interesting that I was reflecting that one way that this appears is it seems sometimes that when we practice metta or compassion or mudita, we're really focusing on the personal. Yeah, is there a way to have a little bit less of that
That's right, the microphone's a little further from your mouth.
Can you get closer?
Turn the volume up.
No.
A little bit further.
A little further.
Too close.
Okay. Too close. Okay. How is this? Can we hear at the back? Okay, very good. So if you look at a few different parts of our practice, you see a kind of what looks like a tension or paradox, again, was that Ruth mentioned. And so metta seems very personal. We have wishes for this being and that being. And sometimes the wisdom dimension seems very impersonal. We just watch thoughts, emotions. We just notice things coming by, you know, and we try not to take things personally when we do mindfulness. That seems different, doesn't it? Could seem different. And with the heart practices, we wish for certain things to occur. We want you to be happy. We want you to be free of suffering, and so forth. And sometimes we do mindfulness practice or wisdom practice, and we're taught not to wish for anything. Just to be with things as they are, right? And so it seems different, right? And another way of looking at that is we seem with metta practice and these heart practices to have goals. We want, you know, we would like this person to be happy, and so forth. But with mindfulness or wisdom practice, we're told just be with things as they are without wanting anything to happen. So they seem different. And they also, these different practices seem to have different temperatures. You know, the heart practices are warm, and the wisdom practices seem cool. In fact, even the notion of Nibbana, one is supposed to be very cool. So, I don't think that, you know, I think the word in English, the word cool as slang, I think that comes from jazz. And I don't think it was influenced by Nibbana. So I don't know for sure. But it's interesting, isn't it? The temperature of the heart practice is warmer. And the wisdom is a little bit cooler, right? A little bit more distanced, yeah. And so what I'm going to suggest is that when we come to equanimity, we bring these together. And that in the maturity of our practice, these all come together. When we train on the way, they can look different. But when we come together, when we bring these together, when they are mature, there is an integration. Now, the fact that you know, there are all these differences, hot and cold, personal and impersonal, means that the languages are a little bit different. So if you even try to think about bringing them together, it may be that you get into paradox. And paradox is usually a good sign. So, well, maybe I'll come back to that. But what it means is that you can't think this out too much. That the integration of the heart and the wisdom is something that the truth is not easy to talk about. Because paradox is about the limits of language. And I think when we mature, it's not so easy to talk about, but it's easy to know what it feels like inside. So equanimity is especially the one of these four that does bring these together, that brings together the developed heart and the wisdom. And in the Buddhist teachings, the word is upekkha. And it usually is understood to mean balance, to have a balance of our mind, a balance of our attention, that we can be balanced more and more, no matter what happens. Difficult experiences, balanced. Easy experiences, balanced. Pleasant experiences, balanced. Unpleasant experiences, balanced. And there's another word that's also close to equanimity, sometimes used, not used as much. And the meaning of that is to look over, as if you're looking from a hill or a mountain. So the sense of equanimity is that you're seeing clearly from the heights. You know, that's part of the meaning as well. And I know in English, we don't use the word equanimity very much. It's not part of common English, right? As a native speaker?
Yeah.
No. Not in... And so it's a little bit of a strange word in English, even. You know, and it... So it means balance. Sometimes we would talk about it as non-reactivity. As evenness. Being even with whatever happens. In the teachings from the Buddha, it's almost always seen as a very advanced quality. And so if you see where it appears in some of the different teachings, it's always the last one mentioned. It's always at the end. And so some of you know there's the teaching of the seven factors of awakening. I remember when I was in Israel 2 years ago, Stephen Fulder taught on seven factors of awakening and at Sangha House in Tel Aviv. Is anyone there at that one? Yeah, because I think I taught two of them. Yeah. I think I taught equanimity. I don't remember. I think I did. I'm equanimous if I did not. It's okay. But equanimity is the last one. And same thing with the Brahmavihara, it's the last one. And some of you know the list of qualities which we developed called the paramis. And the paramis are a list of 10 qualities that are that we develop. I think it starts with generosity, dana. And it goes through mindfulness and wisdom and so forth. Last one is equanimity. And it's sometimes said that equanimity is very close to awakening, very close to nibbana. It's a very powerful and beautiful quality. It's also when one develops concentration, the last of the first four deep states of concentration is connected with equanimity. Ability to be balanced with whatever's happening. I think I mentioned that in Tibetan tradition, when they practice loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, they practice equanimity first because they want to say we have to get the wisdom in there quickly. And so when I once did a retreat about a month on the Brahmavihara, and I started with 2 days just equanimity, and then 7 days loving kindness or metta, 7 days compassion, 7 days mudita, and then 5 days equanimity. It was nice to begin and end with equanimity. And so if you practice at home, you may want to do that. One image that we sometimes use is that equanimity is, let me back up. Equanimity is balanced and non-reactive, but especially in the context of the Brahmavihara, it also involves the kind heart. It involves a quality of care and kindness. not just non-reactivity can sound just purely like a wisdom quality, but here equanimity brings in also, we might say, the caring and the kindness. And so it expresses what we sometimes would call the wise heart, another way to talk about it. And one image that we use sometimes is that equanimity is like a very, very wise grandmother. She has seen everything. Nothing will bother her. She has seen everything. No matter what happens, she's seen everything, but she cares. Right? That can be an image of equanimity. Very wise, very experienced, very balanced, but she's not separate. She still has the kindness and the care. That's equanimity. And I've been very interested in equanimity for a long time. I think it's partly related to the life of my father named Simon. And Simon grew up in New York, and he's had a lot of suffering in his life in certain ways. And he still seemed to be pretty, very balanced. And so when I think of equanimity, I often think of him. He was in 1939, he was 18 years old, and he enlisted in the what became the Air Force. And he saw a lot of his friends die in the World War II. After the war, he went to a university, and he wanted to go to medical school. But at that time in the United States, they had quotas, meaning that only a small percentage of people from Jewish background could go to medical school. That did not change until the 1960s in the US. And so he couldn't go to medical school. And I did not hear bitterness from him. He did well. He became a scientist, a biochemist. But he had those difficulties. He also had psoriasis. He developed pretty young, so he had red scales all over his body. But he was, I think, okay with that, not embarrassed. The last maybe 35 years of his life, he was blind. He did research for the government, and some of it, I think, was not supervised well. And they used chemicals in some of the experiments, and it went into his eyes. And he became blind, maybe 10 years after that. But I did not hear bitterness. There was some kind of balance. And actually, interestingly, maybe you know this from some people who are blind, I think his heart opened more as he couldn't see. Does anyone know that? Sometimes it's like that. Yeah, it's interesting. And then the last 27 years of his life, he developed cancer. And he was supposed to die in 2 years, but he lived 27 years. And it was a lot of a lot of things, way more than I've experienced, difficulties. And I think there was a lot of balance, and I learned something very much from that. And so when I think of equanimity, I think of my father. So I want to talk about some of the qualities of equanimity. So there's balance, first of all. There's a very nice essay by the German Jewish monk named Nyanaponika Thera, who I think became a monk in the 1940s, went to Sri Lanka, and was one of the early writers on Buddhism. Some of you probably know some of his writings. He wrote an early book called The Heart of Buddhist Meditations. Anyone know that book? And he said that equanimity is perfect, unshakable balance, rooted in insight. So it's balance based on wisdom, What?
Can you repeat, please?
Yeah. Equanimity is perfect, unshakable balance of mind rooted in insight. So it's based on wisdom. And so that kind of balance isn't the same as being calm. What's that? Can you hear okay? Okay. So there's a sense of balance isn't the same as calm. So you can be running all around, not calm, you know, all over the place. Maybe sometimes in the kitchen, right? When you're helping with the meal, all of, very busy. You can still be equanimous and balanced. You know, you can still do that. It's also a kind of even-mindedness. You can be even with whatever happens. This is another account of it. You can be balanced and even more and more with whatever occurs. And this is really a fruit of our practice. You know, and in our practice, we often explore beautiful states, but also difficult states. So we sometimes get to know fear or sadness or anxiety or anger. And when you get to know those, they become more familiar. You know, it was like the mountain climber. I think I said a few days ago, like the mountain climber who knows fear very well, but is balanced with fear. Fear is present, you don't shoot the second arrow, right? You don't react because of fear. But that only comes because we've studied it. We've studied in our mindfulness practice, maybe also in our Brahmavihara practice, fear has come up and we've examined it, right? And I know for me, one of the fruits of doing a lot of retreats is that I've had retreats which kind of, in my early time of doing retreats, about half were really wonderful, powerful, pleasant, inspiring, blissful, and about half were difficult, painful, going into, you know, I think I needed that ratio to continue. But I know early in my practice, I had one retreat where I had fear almost the whole retreat. Now, luckily, it was not too much, right? It was sort of, we would say in English, the workable range. And so I could be mindful of it. I wanted it to go away, of course. I was a little bit afraid of my fear. But it didn't go away. And so I stayed with it. But from that experience, I learned so much about fear. It was never the same, right? You know, because I was looking at it, and with mindfulness, you know, it was there a lot. It was there like 15 hours a day for, you know, like 10 days in a row. And after a while, it was very interesting because I could see, you know, fear is always about the future. It's never about the present moment. And I could see how fear had so much delusion. And I was watching it over and over again. I could see that, right? And so when you see that a lot, you can be more balanced when fear arises. And same thing this is your first retreat, this doesn't always happen. So I'm not saying your next retreat, 15 hours of any fear. Maybe just 12. Just joking. But also, I've had retreats where I was angry. One retreat I was angry, also, almost all the time for 10 days in a row. Very interesting. Yeah. And I learned so much about anger. And again, it was a kind of anger that I could be mindful of. It was not too much, you know, which was, it's not always that way, but it was that way for me. And so this is a way we develop equanimity. We develop equanimity a lot by being present with what takes us out of balance and learning from it. And so that's part of the training for equanimity, and that we learn that in the mindfulness practice and in daily life. So I have a haiku that for me expresses very nicely the nature of equanimity in terms of being with what is unpleasant. This is from Basho. Some of you know Japanese haiku. And this is, you know, he was what, the 17th century, I think. And you know, haikus are very short, so you have to listen carefully. But listen to this and see if you can see this as equanimity haiku. Okay, here it is. Fleas, lice, the horse pissing near my pillow. The end. One more time? Okay. Fleas, lice. You know what fleas and lice are? Okay. What?
What's lice?
Yeah. Fleas, lice, the horse pissing. You know what pissing is? It's slang in English. The horse pissing near my pillow. So why is that equanimity haiku? Because I'm interpreted this way. He's very matter-of-fact, right? It's happening, and he just describes it very simply. He doesn't say, oh, that bad horse. Right? He just is describing it very simply. And it's a little bit like we sometimes have in our meditation practice, often mindfulness or maybe metta. You know, something is happening, it's unpleasant. We just say, oh, unpleasant, right? And sometimes we don't have equanimity and we say, when is the unpleasant going to change? Why did I come on this retreat? And so forth. But this is for equanimity, he just stays with it. Okay. So there's another quality of equanimity. Is that when it's strong, it's unshakable. You stay very, very steady, right? No matter what happens. And some of you know the teaching in Buddhist tradition called the eight worldly winds. These are the winds that blow us around and take us out of balance. You know, and they are pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, and fame and disrepute, or you would say having a good reputation or a bad reputation. Right? And so one of the ways that we can practice equanimity is look out for these eight worldly winds. See when they occur. Because they typically, you know, they will make us off balance, right? You know, something like praise and someone blaming you. How many of you can be equanimous with someone blaming you? Not easy, right? So one person raised the hand. Yeah. But it's something that we have, we're very sensitive to blame, right? I remember I was one of the organizers where we had 7-day, kind of 7-day retreat. It was on engaged practice in the summer. And halfway through, we did a survey to see how things were going. And we had, you know, I think we had, you know, like maybe 100 people there. We had all the surveys and we had them in. And almost everyone was having a good time. And maybe 5 people had negative comments. And the organizers all said, oh, we have to focus on that. was very sensitive to the criticism, right? And so, one way to develop equanimity is to work with all of these. And so that could be a beautiful way to bring equanimity into daily life, right? Look out for what happens when there's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, or having a good reputation or bad reputation. Yeah. So that's one way to develop equanimity, is to focus in that way. This is from the Buddha. This is how he developed equanimity. I would make my bed, this is when he was wandering around, I think before he was awakened. I would make my bed in a charnel ground with the bones of the dead for a pillow. So you think conditions at Endor sometimes are not like a hotel, right? Okay, so the Buddha had the bones of the dead for his pillow. And cowherd boys came up and spat on me. They urinated on me, they threw dirt at me, and they poked sticks in my ears. Yet I do not recall that I ever aroused a mind of hatred against them. Such was my abiding in equanimity. So that was his training. So another quality of equanimity that brings in, especially the wisdom quality, so we have balance and evenness and unshakability in mature equanimity. We also have understanding. That's very important for equanimity. That we know the causes and conditions. We get to know them, and when we understand better, we are more balanced. So there's really a sense of knowing how things came to be. I remember learning about Dr. Ariaratne from Sri Lanka. You know, and I did a book on how you bring together meditation and social service and social change. And I interviewed a lot of people. One of the people I interviewed was Dr. Ariaratne from Sri Lanka, who is the founder of an organization called Sarvodaya, which set up about maybe 20,000 local groups where they bring together Buddhist practice and helping the community. Very inspiring. When the tsunami occurred about 15 years ago, they were more effective than the government in helping. It's a very powerful example of bringing practice into the world. And so he said, you know, he was talking about there being a kind of civil war in Sri Lanka, you know. And he said, we have to have a 400-year plan. The problems connected with colonialism and so forth took 400 years to develop. We will need another 400 years to heal everything. So there's this long perspective, right? An understanding of causes and conditions. And you can you hear an equanimity? Okay, we have a 400-year plan. One of the persons I like a lot is a poet named Gary Snyder. Anyone know Gary Snyder's work? Is he known in Israel? Wonderful poet. He's a Zen practitioner. He's now maybe 89. He's been one of my heroes. I've met him a number of times and love his poetry. And he says, to really have perspective on what's happening now, he says it's better to have a 4,000-year perspective. And so that would be connected with equanimity. Having very long view. It gives you patience, right? Patience would be part of what equanimity is. So you can start to see how equanimity is a very mature quality, right? It has all these different aspects. And a friend of mine who's also been a teacher and a colleague, some of you may know, Joanna Macy. She goes beyond 400 years. She says equanimity should be about 15 billion years. 15 billion years, because that's the age of the cosmos. And this is what she said. If we are not separate from the living world, then we should act our age. We are 4.5 billion years old in terms of the origins of life, and 15 billion years old in terms of the Big Bang. Every atom and every molecule and every cell of our body goes back 15 billion years. The life that is now beating our hearts and breathing our lungs didn't begin with our conception. Rather, life flows through us. For me, this is a wonderful doorway into equanimity. So you think I'm part of something that's 15 billion years old. My cells, everything. That's interesting, isn't it? You get a very, very long perspective. And understanding the causes and conditions is also very important for compassion. You know, that if, when we really understand another person, maybe with whom we have difficulty, it becomes compassion. This is from the American poet Longfellow. He says, if we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each person's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. Did you get that?
Yeah.
And we can experience that sometimes. Have you, probably many of us have had maybe difficulty with someone close to us. And sometimes we have a communication where one person just says, this was my experience, right? And maybe we go back 1 week, right? A person just says, this was my experience. And we maybe before this, we were a little bit separate, polarized, right? We say, oh, you did this, you did that, right? And then we hear, we give the person a chance just to speak. This is what it was like from inside. And we hear that, and we hear the story. I said, oh, now I understand. And then that person can hear us. And if there is even a little bit of goodwill, there can be healing of the relationship, right? And probably many of us have had something like that. So this is a sense of that the understanding can really bring a kind of balance, that a lot of times we're out of balance because we don't understand, or we have very limited information. Right? There's also a quality of equanimity which has an aspect of faith. That we are willing to be with things, and we have some faith that we can be with things and that things will be okay, no matter what's happening. That we can, faith in the sense that I can be with the situation and know that there's the best chance for wisdom and kindness to develop, you know, from my experience. That I can never feel too far away from wisdom and compassion. So it doesn't mean faith that it will happen the way I want. But there's a faith maybe that I can be with it, that I can be with anything. And I think equanimity also has a quality of joy. There can be often joy when there's that sense of balance. I was thinking of a few examples. One of them was, I think, of the civil rights movement in the United States. And something that's very powerful for me to look at is like the images from the 1960s, maybe, or 1950s, of older African Americans who've known a lot of suffering, right? And they have a kind of joy and lightness despite everything. And that for me is like, there's a joy with equanimity. It can be there, can be very powerful. I also thought of the Dalai Lama, that he has a lot of joy. Anyone met the Dalai Lama? Yeah, very good. Has he come to Israel?
No.
It was in Ladakh.
What?
In Ladakh.
In Ladakh, yeah. And so the Dalai Lama, he asks everyone who comes from Tibet to talk with him. So he hears stories about torture. He hears them all the time. And he still has a lot of joy. You know, my sister, when she went to graduate school, she was a waitress at a restaurant where the Dalai Lama came with a bunch of monks. She said they were laughing the whole time. I think they gave good tip. But there was that, you know, I was saying that because he deals with a lot of difficulty and suffering, but there's a joy there also. It's interesting, I think that's a lot of sign of equanimity as well. That he's in connection with his own joy, even though he's also in connection with difficulties and a lot of pain. So a few more things about equanimity, and then I think we'll work with the practice tomorrow morning, practice of equanimity. So those are some of the qualities of equanimity. But when we're practicing equanimity, whether in our mindfulness practice or as a Brahmavihara, there are dangers that the equanimity can become not so connected with the heart. That's probably the main difficulty. And so I think we've mentioned a little bit that each of the four Brahmavihara has a possible distortion, a possible way that they are not authentic. I think we mentioned that loving kindness, it is the kind of caring that's grabbing or possessive and so forth. And for compassion, it's pity. So it's a little bit distanced and thinking of, oh, you poor suffering person. I am better than you. You are suffering. That's pity. There's some compassion, but it's not mature, right? For equanimity, this near enemy is called indifference. It lacks the kind heart, right? And so it can be, sometimes maybe it's a little more intellectual, right? We get too focused on the wisdom and we don't bring in the heart. This would be a danger of the practice. That's why I really love that we do equanimity practice along with the other three heart practices, because when we do that, they all get mixed together. I think I mentioned earlier, I have a Tibetan teacher named Mingyur Rinpoche, and he said that when you do practices kind of on the same day, they mingle. They come together. I like that. Or when you do them near each other, right? They mingle and they integrate. So I was very interested when I was thinking about the value of equanimity in sort of spiritual activism. It was very interesting for me because when I looked at people, I found a lot of other sort of dangers of what we call these near enemies. So, for example, something that kind of looks like equanimity, but it's not authentic. So I was thinking of something like complacency. Do you know that word? Mm-hmm. Complacency means?
Shananut.
Yeah. It means that you're kind of, you think that everything is okay, But it's not okay. And that could be a near enemy. Another one in English would be resignation. It's when you when something difficult has happened and you say, I give up, and you don't try anymore. And that kind of looks, you could be, oh, I'm kind of balanced, but it's because you're not trying anymore. That would be a near enemy also. Another one could be feeling numb. You can look like you're balanced because you're frozen. Right? You're not affected by things because you're a little bit stuck, right? That can look like equanimity, but it's not really. And sometimes the equanimity can be too intellectual, not enough of the kind heart. Gary Snyder did a very beautiful little, very short poem that I wanted to read, which kind of brings this out.
How do you spell Snyder?
S-N-Y-D-E-R, yeah. He lives in the mountains in California. Yeah. And he did some writing in 2001 after the Taliban blew up the Buddhas in Afghanistan. Some of you may remember that or know of that. You know, there were these, I don't know, 2,000-year-old or 1,500-year-old huge Buddhas, you know, on the side of a mountain, right? And the Taliban blew them up, and people were concerned. And someone wrote to Gary Snyder basically saying, isn't everything impermanent? Why do you care? Right? And a little bit intellectual, right? And could be, maybe. And he said, ah, yes, impermanence. And so this is sort of where, again, we bring together the wisdom and the kind heart. And so he's going to be quoting another haiku from a haiku writer named Isa from Japan from, I think, beginning of the 19th century. And Isa wrote a famous haiku when his young son died. And he was talking about impermanence, right? And he quoted from some lines from the Diamond Sutra, which talks a lot about impermanence and says, this world is like a dewdrop at dawn, meaning everything passes quickly. And so he wrote these lines about how, yes, things are impermanent, and it's not the end of the story. Basically saying there has to be the heart and compassion. So anyways, that's the background for this to understand. So Gary Snyder says, ah yes, impermanence. But this is never a reason to let compassion and focus slide or to pass off the sufferings of others because they are merely impermanent beings. The haiku goes, this dewdrop world is but a dewdrop world, meaning everything impermanent. And yet, then he's thinking about his son. It's a dewdrop world, and yet, basically saying wisdom and compassion, not just the wisdom. Yeah. And then Gary Snyder says, and yet is our perennial practice. And maybe the root of the Dharma. Yeah. So maybe the last thing I will say about equanimity is that it also is not passive. That equanimity, because it's linked to compassion, it's connected with action also. It's connected with being responsive. It's not just a passive capacity. That equanimity, and actually, is the basis for skillful action. But it's not about simply being passive. And again, I found this when I interviewed people for this book, I found so many people had deep equanimity. I heard amazing stories of sort of bringing equanimity into action and what it looks like. And yeah. So I think I'll finish by pointing to how equanimity brings together especially these three other qualities with it. And that, again, one of the beautiful teachings about the Brahma-Vihara is that, number one, they all have to go together. If you don't, you know, if you don't have equanimity with your compassion, you'll get knocked around. If you don't have joy with your compassion, there'll be burnout. Right? If you have equanimity without kindness or metta or compassion, it'll be too dry. Right? And so it's pointing to how they all come together, how they all are needed. And this is, again, it's something that's maybe more of an experience. Again, we go into the little bit different languages for wisdom and kindness. So I think I'll finish. This is also from Nyanaponikatera. It's a very beautiful essay about the Brahma-Vihara, pretty short. And we're going to give, I think, probably tomorrow. Is it tomorrow we give a reading list? Or when do we give? Maybe we haven't decided. The last day, maybe. Yeah, the last day we've prepared a resource list for you for everything from the retreat, which we'll have, books and articles and web links and, you know, all sorts of things. Talks.
Poems.
Excuse me?
Poems.
Poems. We have more work to do then. Okay. Maybe version two. We didn't want to use too much paper. Okay, ecological. Well, okay, a haiku, okay. You're very good back and forth. Okay. So anyway, this is an essay called The Four Sublime States. Sublime States is another way to talk about Brahma-Vihara. And it's a beautiful essay that talks about each of them and then talks about how they're interrelated. So I'll end with this. And remember, they're understood as, when they're mature, they become limitless. It's like the meditation we did. They go off into space, and they, like in the Metta Sutta, you know, radiating kindness over the entire world. All of these, and in Tibetan tradition, they're understood as the immeasurables. They radiate out from the heart in space without limit. You know, and you see that in the text. Okay. Unbounded metta guards compassion against turning into partiality for one person or one side. So when maybe we have compassion for someone who suffered, but do we care about the other person? Or maybe there's injustice, right? Do we only care about one side? Right? And so metta helps to avoid that sense of, I only have my compassion for you, not for you. That would be a danger. Unbounded metta guards compassion against turning into partiality for one person or one side. Metta imparts to equanimity its selflessness, its boundless nature, and even its fervor, its energy. Yeah. Compassion prevents metta and sympathetic joy from forgetting that while both are enjoying her giving temporary and limited happiness, there still exists suffering. So compassion tells metta and joy, yes, you may be happy and joyful, but there's also suffering out there, right? Yeah, don't get too self-centered. Compassion does not allow that metta and joy shut themselves up against the world by confining themselves to a narrow sector. In other words, it says, bring the metta and joy also where they're suffering. Not just to have, okay, I have my little private place. So it's a big vision, right? Compassion guards equanimity from falling into cold indifference and keeps it from indolent or selfish isolation. So equanimity, I might be, oh, I'm very equanimous. I live on the top of the hill. I don't see any suffering. Right? I'm kind of privileged, we might say, right? And so compassion balances that. Joy holds compassion back from being overwhelmed by suffering, right? From being absorbed by it to the exclusion of everything else. Joy relieves the tension of mind, soothes the painful burning of the compassionate heart. It keeps compassion from brooding without purpose. You know, from saying, oh, everything's so bad, oh. So joy balances that. Joy gives to equanimity the mild serenity that softens its stern appearance. It is the smile on the face of the Buddha, a smile that persists in spite of the Buddha's deep knowledge of the world's sufferings. The Buddha smiles even though the Buddha knows the suffering. A smile that gives solace and hope, fearlessness and confidence. So as we do all of these four practices, they mingle and they tend to help each other, right? And they integrate. And so very important to have all four together. And that's what we're doing. So we'll just sit for a few moments to reflect. We can reflect on what may have been helpful or important. Or maybe something that I said just sparked something totally unrelated to what I was saying. And that it was important. Yeah, so just see what was important for you in your experience of the talk. Thank you for your very kind attention. And tomorrow we will bring in further equanimity practice. And kind of like dessert. So we have now a half hour of walking, then we come back for chanting. And we'll do, probably do at least two chants.